Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Boston-based journalist Michael Corcoran, who discusses his recent article titled Playing Defense, How Progressives Could Push Democrats to Block the Trump Agenda. Stacy Mitchell of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, who talks about her group's new report, Amazon Stranglehold, how the company's tightening grip is stifling competition, eroding jobs, and threatening communities. And Stephanie Sosi, associate attorney with Earth Justice, who assesses the struggles that may lie ahead after the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers refused to grant the Dakota Access Pipeline an easement to cross the Missouri River. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Enduring growing frustration with Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte over his bloody war on drugs, Vice President Leni Robredo resigned from the cabinet as housing secretary. Robredo claims she was blocked from attending cabinet meetings, and now, in her new role as vice president, she will lead the opposition to Duterte. Robredo is a human rights lawyer whose husband, the interior secretary, died in a 2012 plane crash. In her resignation statement, Robredo said she has major differences in principles and values with President Duterte, who launched a war on drug dealers that has cost the lives of nearly 5,000 Filipinos killed by vigilantes and police extrajudicial killings. Robredo has also protested Duterte's decision to move the body of former dictator Ferdinand Marcos to the Philippines' Heroes Cemetery. Robredo narrowly defeated Marcos' son in the last election. Robredo is the second key official to resign from Duterte's administration in less than a week. Maria Serena Diokno quit as head of the government's historical commission recently in protest of Duterte's decision to allow Marcos' burial in the nation's most honored cemetery. In early December, President Duterte made a brief congratulatory phone call to U.S. President-elect Donald Trump. The Philippines president stated Trump endorsed his violent war on drugs. When the Shiite-dominated Iraqi army drove ISIS out of the city of Tikrit in early 2015, there were fears of sectarian revenge killings provoked by the 2014 ISIS slaughter of 1,700 Iraqi Shiite cadets at Tikrit's Camp Spiker. Trained facilitators from Sunni and Shiite communities worked in the months following the retreat of ISIS fighters to identify the individuals who committed the atrocities and to resist condemning the entire Sunni population. The reconciliation process, funded by the U.S. Institute of Peace, could be a model for Mosul as it plans to rebuild after ISIS rebels are driven out of Iraq's second-largest city. Omar Tariq Ismail, Tikrit's mayor, told the Christian Science Monitor, "When we started, all signs looked very bad. We thought it was a lost cause. But after trained facilitators moved into Sunni and Shiite communities, tensions eased and tribal leaders took responsibility for the individuals involved in the massacre. Sunni leaders in Tikrit also provided evidence that they too were victims of ISIS brutality and revealed how local Sunnis saved the lives of 500 Shiite cadets. In front of dozens of TV satellite channels, Tikrit's Sunni tribal leaders condemned the massacre at Camp Spiker, blamed ISIS for the mass killings, and promised to help Iraqi security forces identify individuals from Sunni tribes who participated in the massacre. Since ISIS was driven out, Tikrit has come back to life with bustling streets, busy shops, and restored city services like water and power." A week after the election of Donald Trump as president, pastors gathered at the basement of a downtown New York City church to plot their resistance to Trump's promised mass deportation of immigrants. Many of these faith leaders were immigrants themselves and are the driving force behind the New Sanctuary Coalition of New York City, founded in 2007. According to The Nation magazine, physical sanctuary goes far beyond simply advocating for immigrant rights. It means houses of worship covertly host immigrants facing deportation. Physical sanctuary could consist of a short-term stay in a safe place to avoid a raid by ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or a long-term stay while awaiting a court ruling. Currently, 11 Christian congregations in New York City provide physical sanctuary to immigrants in jeopardy, and immigrant rights activists are working to dramatically increase that number before Trump is sworn into office on January 20th. During the campaign, Trump also pledged to end President Obama's DACA program, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, that protects 800,000 dreamers born to undocumented immigrants from deportation. During the 8 years of President Obama's administration, 2.4 million immigrants have been deported, a 21% increase over the number of deportations ordered during George W. Bush's years in office. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
When Donald Trump takes the oath of office on January 20th, he'll become president of a nation divided. He'll have captured the White House through winning 270 votes in the Electoral College, an archaic and undemocratic feature of the U.S. Constitution, while losing the popular vote to Hillary Clinton by more than 2.8 million votes. A cloud hangs over Mr. Trump's election as questions grow about his business conflicts of interest and calls mount for a congressional investigation into the role Russia may have played in hacking and leaking Democratic Party emails during the campaign to benefit the Republican Party candidate. Although Trump will enter office as a minority president, his appointments and nominations thus far signal that he's operating as though he has a decisive popular mandate to institute sweeping and radical change. The real estate mogul is building an administration made up of millionaires and billionaires, many of whom are connected to the fossil fuel industry, proclaim climate change to be a hoax, favor the privatization of education, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, and advocate across-the-board corporate, banking, and environmental deregulation. As Democrats prepare to defend against the Trump agenda, which includes the dismantling of much of the nation's social safety net, Obamacare, and an assault on reproductive rights, one of the few tools they'll have is the Senate filibuster, which itself could be lost if Senate Republicans vote to eliminate it. Your reporter spoke with Michael Corcoran, a Boston-based journalist, who discusses his recent article titled "Playing Defense: How Progressives Could Push Democrats to Block the Trump Agenda."
It might sound hypocritical in some sense for people on the left or progressives or however you want to label it to say the Democrats should be obstructionists, because one common critique is, oh, you're not letting Congress do its job, et cetera, et cetera. But the Republicans did show, even when they didn't have a lot of power, in, say, 2009, 2010, when the Affordable Care Act was being adopted, and they were so militantly opposed, you know, they had the Democrats, you know, debating with themselves and conceding things to industry and conceding things to members of their own party. So in many ways, especially on things like global warming or also reproductive rights, there's certain issues where they'll be able to rally and to be uniformed in their opposition to Trump. On some areas, say infrastructure, there might be some pressure for them to make common cause. And I guess the devil is in the details, but my biggest fear is that if there is going to be a coalition where some Democrats work with the Republicans, it's probably not going to be Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and that wing of the party. I think it would be more likely to be the more conservative Democrats that are being pressured and lobbied so heavily by industry. And so say they want to come up with some kind of tax deal or they want to cut Medicare and entitlement reform. And then you could see a few of the more conservative Democrats aligning themselves with Trump. I do think obstruction on some level could be a valuable tactic and should be used at least on several areas, and even on issues where they're going to lose, even on issues where obstruction is not enough. In order to get the base rallied, in order for them to kick out the Republicans in 2018, kick out Trump in 2020, to convince working class voters that they are a party that they can get behind, they're going to have to show opposition on a very staunch and militant way. And I also think that it's incumbent on the public to pressure them to do it, because they are not inclined to do it on their own often. largely because of that pressure from industry.
Michael, what are the signals that we've seen so far from Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York and Nancy Pelosi, the House Minority Leader from California? What have they been saying about their tactics here when Trump comes in as president?
There's been some mixed signals. There was an article in the Times recently, and there were some quotes where Schumer and others were seeking to, quote, align with Trump on some issues. Now, how much of this is serious or how much of it is political posturing to pressure Trump, you know, who knows? So that's a concern. And I recall when Schumer said they were looking for ways to align with Trump, that there was a blowback from progressive organizations like Democracy for America and others who are saying, you know, we can't play, I'm paraphrasing, but Democracy for America said, stop playing footsie with Donald Trump because, one, we don't want to normalize him, and, two, it's hard to imagine any kind of coalition where the policies will be that good. Bernie Sanders has said if Trump comes out for an infrastructure policy that benefits the working class, I would be willing to work with him then. But I also think Sanders, if you could put truth serum in him, doesn't expect Trump's policies to probably meet his standards. So there's been some statements that are open to working with him. But on the other hand, Nancy Pelosi, who you mentioned, she has gone and said she will do what it takes to protect Medicare. So early signs are mixed. Clearly, many Democrats are pretty militant against. I mean, some of them are trying to keep him out of the White House now with the Russian interference and the Hamilton electors. So that seems to be a sign of militance in opposition to Trump. But I won't believe it until I see it, you know, which is another reason why I advocate that progressives demand that Democrats really genuinely try to stop Trump when they can and not to try to work with him, at least not too often or on certain issues.
What leverage do activist groups have in the country to push the Democrats in a direction of more confrontation and less cooperation?
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that because I think, right, you know, just broadly speaking, especially since Citizens United, the biggest weakness voters have and the public has is that when Congress is sitting there in Washington being bombarded by lobbyists who fund their campaigns, and this includes most Democrats, not all of them, sometimes they prioritize the needs of the industry who they require versus the public. So the public pressure has to be overwhelming in order to force them to pay attention to it. But when you talk about leverage, one thing that is a new variable that has not been the case is that someone like Bernie Sanders is arguably the most popular politician in the Democratic caucus, and Elizabeth Warren is very popular. Neither of them get money from, you know, Wall Street, for instance, and they might be the only two senators in the entire caucus that don't get funded on some level from Wall Street. So because those two senators are so popular, that could be an avenue for activists to try to align with them and urge them to make statements from the pulpits that they have and use the windows that they have, because that is a new variable, the fact that we have some progressive leaders that have shown to have a following. And Bernie Sanders could make conservative Democrats' lives rather difficult if he wants to, because he has such a following.
That was Boston-based journalist Michael Corcoran. Find links to his recent Playing Defense article and related news and analysis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Most Americans know Amazon.com as a super convenient online marketplace where you can buy almost anything and get it delivered to your doorstep super fast. But the Institute for Local Self-Reliance has just published a report focusing on the negative impact the company has had in several areas of American life. The group's concerns are expressed in this quote from the report's introduction. They state, Amazon's increasing dominance comes with high costs. It's eroding opportunity and fueling inequality. And it's concentrating power in ways that endanger competition, community life, and democracy. The report titled, Amazon's Stranglehold, How the Company's Tightening Grip is Stifling Competition, Eroding Jobs, and Threatening Communities, is divided into four sections: monopolizing the economy, undermining jobs and wages, weakening communities, and government support for Amazon. The Institute then suggests steps that policymakers can take to check the company's power and bring about a more competitive and equitable economy. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Stacy Mitchell, co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, and co-author of their Amazon report. Here she provides an overview of her group's concern about Amazon's economic impact and how establishing new public policies could protect both workers and communities.
We've been really struck by the fact that this company has become very dominant across the retail sector, has more and more of our transactions are happening on Amazon. This is a company that's enormously powerful and yet remains very invisible to most people. I mean, most of us, you know, we see the package arrive on the doorstep, and that's really about all we really know about this company. And so this report was a way to pull back the curtain and take a look at how much Amazon has grown and then what the implications are of its growing dominance over our economy and our communities, and really to ask some questions about whether we shouldn't be concerned about that dominance. Just to give you a sense of how big Amazon is now, they're now capturing one out of every $2 that Americans spend online, which is enormous. You know, online retail is growing very rapidly. Amazon's share of that is growing even faster. We project that within 5 years, a fifth of everything Americans buy will be bought online, and that Amazon will capture two-thirds of those dollars. The company has more than doubled in size, its distribution infrastructure in the last year. They're now the largest seller of books and toys, and by next year they'll be the biggest seller of apparel and consumer electronics, both online and off. And they're making big investments in areas like groceries and across a whole bunch of different industries. And as we document in this report, there are some significant hidden consequences and costs to that dominance.
Stacey Mitchell, I read an article years ago about the horrible working conditions at Amazon warehouses, so I don't think of the company kindly, but almost everyone I know loves Amazon.
What we remind people of in this report is that Amazon has really caused this dramatic die-off of independent retailers, as well as squeezing national chains and leaving more and more vacancy across our communities, and fewer opportunities for people to start and grow a business, as well as fewer jobs. You know, one of the findings of this report is that Amazon has actually eliminated more jobs at retail stores than it's created in its warehouses. And then we looked at the quality of those jobs in its warehouses and found that they're very low paid and incredibly grueling work, a lot of it done not by full-time direct employees of Amazon, but done by temporary workers. So when you start to look at how this company is impacting our economy from a jobs and quality of work standpoint, it's very concerning.
And to think back in the day that Amazon started out as just an online bookseller.
You know, Amazon has this enormous power to pick winners and losers in the publishing industry, and that is problematic both for authors and publishers, but also for us as readers. We should not want a single company to have that kind of power. And as big as Amazon is in the book industry, what's really shocking is that books only account for about 7% of Amazon's sales. As a company, Amazon has become so big in all of these other categories. Amazon wants to be the gatekeeper for everything. They want all of our transactions to flow through, you know, a single pipeline called Amazon. And we really question whether one company should have that kind of power.
Your report notes that Amazon has consolidated its hold over retail in America, but also how much clout Amazon wields in Washington. And part of that, I guess, is the fact that Amazon founder Jeff Bezos now owns the Washington Post.
The last section of this report, we document the ways in which Amazon has strategically manipulated government in order to propel its growth. Amazon has a huge overseas tax haven where they're saving billions of dollars in federal taxes, and they've been able to lower their effective federal tax rate to about a third of what other retailers pay through this kind of quasi-illegal tax transfer scheme that they have going. We also document the fact that local and state governments have given Amazon in the last 10 years over $700 million in direct subsidies to fund construction of its warehouses. Amazon, in order to maintain those favors, which have played a big role in its growth, and of course its competitors, small businesses in particular, don't have access to any of those things. This really distorts the playing field for them. In order to maintain those favors, Amazon has built up a tremendous lobbying capacity within Washington, D.C. They spend more money lobbying than other big companies, more money than Walmart spends, more money than Apple spends. And, of course, it's quite striking that Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, now owns the Washington Post, which is the paper of record for the nation's elected officials. I find that, you know, very concerning and alarming.
That was Stacy Mitchell, co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Find a link to the group's Amazon Stranglehold report and related information by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The largest gathering of indigenous tribes in the U.S. in many decades came together in North Dakota in July to protest the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and their native and non-native allies won an important victory on December 4th when the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers refused to grant the pipeline an easement to cross under the Missouri River. Opponents of the pipeline project organized to protect the Standing Rock Tribe's sacred burial sites and the waters of the Missouri River from being crossed by a fracked oil pipeline that they believed endangered their only source of drinking water. The Anti-Pipeline Coalition employed a variety of tactics that included nonviolent civil disobedience protests, lawsuits, and a boycott of banks investing in the project. Overall, activists calling themselves water protectors were successful in focusing attention on their struggle across the U.S. and the world. Confrontations between activists and North Dakota law enforcement resulted in hundreds of arrests and several serious injuries. Your reporter spoke with Stephanie Sosi, associate attorney with Earth Justice, an environmental law group that has litigated the case on behalf of the Standing Rock Tribe. Here she assesses the decision of the Army Corps of Engineers to conduct an environmental impact review of the pipeline and explore alternate routes, as well as the likely struggles ahead under President-elect Trump, who's an outspoken supporter of the pipeline project.
So in July, we filed a complaint alleging violations of the National Environmental Policy Act and the Clean Water Act and some other environmental statutes and the National Historic Preservation Act that the Army Corps hadn't properly consulted with the tribe. And since then, we've had a few rounds of litigation. We had the preliminary injunction hearing in August, the temporary restraining order hearing in September, and what our case did was highlight a lot of the issues that existed. So the tribe wasn't properly consulted. The environmental review was very limited in scope and didn't accurately consider the risk of oil spills. The tribe was not given due consideration, especially with its proximity to the crossing under Lake Oahe. And so our lawsuit brought a lot of those legal issues to light. In terms of the protests and the camp, I think what happened there is we were able to garner some media attention. And it demonstrated how strongly people felt this issue was. You know, when you have thousands of people out vehemently opposing the process, basically the tribe was steamrolled and forced to accept the risks of a multi-billion dollar pipeline right at its doorstep, going under its main source of drinking water. And so with that progress, with the legal issues highlighted and the passions of the people highlighted, I think what happened is the Army Corps decided to take a step back. The announcement from last week was great for us, and it highlights that the Army Corps didn't really consider the concerns of the tribe. And so this EIS process, this new environmental impact statement, the Corps decided that was the best way to look at some of the issues it hadn't considered before and also possibly looking at alternate routes. And so it's been a crazy few months, but we still have a process to go through with the EIS. We are still in active litigation. We had a status conference in D.C. last week to sort of set out the schedule for some of our briefing and some of the steps of litigation that we still have left.
What are the options for the company now in terms of any right of appeal they may have for this Army Corps of Engineers decision? and the likely course of action for the Trump administration when they come in, where they've publicly expressed their support for building the pipeline at the original site under the Missouri River, right near where the Standing Rock Sioux tribe is.
Well, Dakota Access has filed a motion in the district court in D.C., and they are alleging that they already received the easement back in July, and that's something that we're going to litigate, and the court has set a timeline for hearing that claim. You know, the Army Corps, they've made a decision, and it's really hard for them to overturn that without building a new record and without coming up with a reasoned explanation for doing so. So if they were to reverse with the change in administration, we would challenge that in court. So I guess there's two different questions of whether or not they can and whether or not they will. And they certainly can. We'll litigate it. Whether or not they will, we're not sure.
What's the wider significance of this fight over the Dakota Access Pipeline, in your view? Why should Americans be paying attention to this issue in this case?
Well, I think something that is striking is that this pipeline is, you know, approximately 1,200 miles long, crosses through four states, and received very little federal oversight. There is no big pipeline permit in this case. But they were able to go through and build before they got all of the federal permits that they needed. And also without a lot of federal oversight, federal approval, it's crossing hundreds of water bodies throughout the four states. It has impacts on fish and wildlife. Obviously, there is a concern that any of the analysis didn't really look at oil spill risks. And I think that's concerning. That should be concerning that, you know, in the future or even now, another similarly situated pipeline could happen just as long, and that gets pushed through without really any checks and balances or oversight from the Army Corps or, you know, any other federal agency that has an interest in protecting lands and people.
That was Stephanie Soce, Associate Attorney with Earth Justice, an environmental law group that has litigated against the North Dakota Access Pipeline on behalf of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. For more information on groups organizing resistance to the pipeline project, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Mixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.